This is the Bitcoin Made Simple podcast. Here's your host, Corey Tusick.
This is the Bitcoin Made Simple podcast. I'm your host, Corey Tusick. On today's episode, I interview Natalie Brunell. Natalie has her own podcast called Coin Stories. And she, you know, it's a spinoff of her other one where she discusses careers with people and how they get into their careers. So she, her podcast, she talks to people about their story, how they got into Bitcoin and everything like that. So I thought it'd be good to have her on and have her tell her coin story. And, you know, we get into other things. I mean, we talk all things Bitcoin, and then we even talk a little bit about her Emmy that if you watch on the YouTube link, she's got an Emmy up behind her on her shelf. So different things like that and what her her jobs are like. So it was a great conversation. Really enjoyed having her. If you want to reach out to the show, just follow me on Twitter at Bitcoin Simply, and you can follow my personal Twitter account at Tusick Corey, and then you can email the show bitcoinmadesimplepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks. Apologies. I know we've been trying for a while, and then this is probably why I need a producer and also an assistant for my regular companies. And then also, I'm working from home still, as we all are. And it's just, I was supposed to have an office like 2 weeks ago, and something out of my hands fell through on that. And so here I am again at home, and I have two young ones who I love dearly, but you know, it throws a wrench in things. And then we had to cancel the last time because my dog got sick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I apologize, Natalie. Thank you so much for your patience. I think we've been trying to do this for probably a month now.
I know. Our schedule, the pandemic is always difficult on people's lives and schedules.
Especially you correspondents who are all over the place. How does that work? Because I mean, you probably get gigs like last minute, right?
Yeah, it really just depends. I mean, my job separate from the podcast is for a local news network in Los Angeles. And so I cover everything, primarily investigative news, but really, you know, things can pop up at any given time. So it changes my schedule quite a bit.
Yeah. It puts you all over the place, and you have an Emmy behind you.
Yes.
So if you're not watching the video, she has an Emmy right over her shoulder. Is that the, so you got a local Emmy, I assume, for the reporting, or how'd you get that?
Yeah. So I have one from one of my previous, news markets. I have a nomination for an investigative story, and then I won an Emmy for a breaking news piece. And then actually I'm up for a new Emmy. I just got this in the mail.
Oh, nice.
I'm up for a second Emmy. It's for my reporting work locally.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So you're with LA, with KTLA?
No, I'm with Channel One. It's cable spectrum news.
Okay. Sorry, I forgot. I was looking through my notes and I had KTLA written down, I thought. So Spectrum News, is that's just LA based, or is that nationwide?
So we have affiliates across the country, but I'm based in Los Angeles, and I cover local news here for that network. Yeah.
Okay. And then, so we'll get into your background more, but then, so that has turned into now a full-time podcast host gig in addition to your original podcast. So are you doing both simultaneously?
Yeah. So the podcasts are completely independent and separate from my work for the network. And those are just passion projects that I started. I launched my first podcast in 2018. It's called Career Stories. It still exists. And it's where I interview basically people within the media space about how they achieved their success. So it's origin stories. It's very similar to the format of How I Built This with Guy Raz. And I interviewed everyone from journalists to producers to politicians to social media influencers, famous fitness trainers. And I just love getting people's backstories. So essentially, Coin Stories is really a part of that. It's sort of a spinoff, and it's specifically focused on the Bitcoin space because I wanted to get to know some of the biggest names and where they came from, how they achieved their various levels of success in their careers. and why they believe in Bitcoin and crypto.
Mm-hmm. It sounds, yeah, that's, I wonder, is it also partially, because the reason I started a podcast was to protect my investment, like, and not protect it, like, as if what I'm doing is going to affect it at all. It's just that I needed to learn more about it. So like, well, what a better way to learn about it than, you know, like they always say, if you want to learn about a subject, you know, write a book about it, or make, in my field, I make a movie about it, you know, so then you become obsessed with it and you know, learn everything. So like, well, if I want to make sure I'm making the right call here, I'm going to go make a Bitcoin podcast. Is that kind of what you did?
Yeah, I really wanted to learn more about the space. And like I said, I've just always been fascinated with backstories. And I wanted to know why some of these really smart folks who had a lot of experience at hedge funds or in the financial space or economics or technology really believed in it. I just thought it would be a good way to learn and just expand my knowledge so that I could, you know, potentially also help teach people about not really even Bitcoin, but more so financial freedom and economics and saving. Because I think that message, you know, it's important to get that out to the general public. And I think a lot of people just, it's very intimidating to even think about things like investing or the stock market. Mm-hmm. And I think that the message just needs to be simplified a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I try to take the approach of like, cause I'm not an economics person at all. So I don't think I'm self-deprecating saying I'm dumb, but I'm like, if I can dumb this down to the point where I get it, like, you know, because it's terrifying. And but what is more terrifying is the amount of people that, you know, get into like their 50s or 60s and have done zero financial planning and, you know, understanding of the macro. So your background, so you're born in Poland, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which I have, you're, you know, obviously born there, but I think I'm a quarter Polish.
Oh, cool.
It's Polish. And then I think my other three grandparents are all from Czechoslovakia. That's some of my heritage, but anyways, you were born there. So what was that like? And you know, what brought you to the United States?
Yeah. So I don't really, to be honest, remember my time in Poland because I was very little when we immigrated, but I've heard a lot of stories from my parents and my grandparents of what life was like there. My mom and dad grew up in a communist country. Communism didn't end in Poland until about 1989. And we came to the US in 1991. So it was definitely a big transition. My parents dreamt of just a better life for their kids. And they wanted to come so that my brother and I could go get a really good education. And there was just that sense of upward mobility and being able to achieve the American dream here. So they immigrated, and I was really blessed because my family, I feel like, gave me the opportunity to be in a place where I could really study what I want and pursue the kind of career that I wanted. Of course, my parents being immigrants, they really wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer, and I disappointed them going into the media world. But you know, yeah, it's really humbled me.
I'm sure they're okay with it now.
Yeah. The Emmy helps. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I think, you know, being from an immigrant family really humbles and grounds me. And it's, I've always definitely had a sense of just wanting to save a lot and being very aware of money and making sure that I don't want to end up in a situation where I'm lacking money or I'm afraid, you know, that, a few paychecks and I'm kind of on the streets. So, it's just that like immigrant hustle that I think that they instilled in me and that I've always had. And I really admire my parents for starting over really in their 30s and 40s when they came here. And really, again, it's like that hustle, like, no one helped them. They helped themselves. They didn't ask for handouts. Like, they just worked really, really, really hard to make a better life for their kids.
Yeah. You know, and it's that story, I think, goes really like untold. You know, I mean, like, we're all familiar in the United States with the immigrants, you know, coming from, you know, Mexico and south of the border. You know, there's just so many, you know, like misconceptions about them. And I think actually the episode I will release before this one, I briefly talked about it with Lamar Wilson, but I, there was a family I saw, like, and they had a 4-year-old and, you know, kids close to my age, and they were on the street, and they just had a sign like said, you know, God bless, anything helps, you know? And so I just asked them, all I could think in my mind was that girl's probably never had like a Happy Meal in her life. So like, oh, you know, like, can I get you a Happy Meal? And, you know, what do you guys want? And so I just like talked to them for, you know, 5-10 minutes to hear, you know, hey, like, you know, where are you guys from? And they're from the Ukraine. And in Russia, and they are fleeing to come here. And like firsthand, you know, I said, oh, like, so how, you know, what are you looking to do? And he said, I'm waiting for my immigration papers. He's like, I literally can't work until I get them, you know? And like, that's really sad. So he was like, I'm willing to work. I'm ready to work. He's like, it kills me to beg for money, but that's what we have to do, you know? So you got the, you know, it sounds like your parents, I mean, they hopefully didn't have to do that part of it, but, you know, once they, you said you left, that you came in 91. So communism in Poland ended in 89. So it sounds like as soon as communism ended, they were like, all right, let's figure this out. Let's get a plan going of how to get out of here just in case.
Well, no, actually. So, they waited for 20 years. So they had started applying 20 years prior to when they were actually able to go. And, you know, I think that people, like, you know, everyone wants to make any story like a black and white narrative, mm-hmm. right? And immigration is just like Bitcoin. Immigration is so nuanced. And, you know, every country has a certain amount. There's like a lottery system, a certain amount of people that can come, or a family member has to apply. There are all these, you know, very specific rules, and some people wait forever and they can't come. And so for my family, it was like 2 decades. My mom really wanted to be able to come when she was younger, because she thought it would give her more opportunity to really create a career for herself here. And, you know, for me, I really admire the fact that when she was finally able to come at 38 years old, she didn't just say, you know what, like, it's too late, I'm just going to stay here mm-hmm. and figure it out. She was still like, no, I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'll work multiple jobs, but I'm going to do it. And so I think a lot of my fire and motivation comes from her and my dad. Mm-hmm. Sacrificing like that, you know, because people ask me, they're like, how do you, you know, you do your network, you do your podcast on, you know, on the side. I also teach at a university, and they're like, how do you have the energy? And I was like, I don't know. I just, this is all I know. This is what my parents did. Like,
your parents gave you the hustle, you know, they.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder about that sometimes, like, and especially just in the last year, even exploring Bitcoin, I sometimes think about just like, what inspires and motivates people to really have that sort of drive and passion? Because there are some people who literally, you know, they don't graduate from college, or they come here with absolutely nothing. I have a friend's dad who moved to the United States with literally like $6 in his bank account from Israel. And he's now a billionaire. He created a company with his brothers. And then other people, you know, they really suffer and they struggle, or they fall into drugs or alcohol, and they it's just interesting. Like what, you know, what drives people, and how some people are able to take struggle and really capitalize on it and use it for momentum to achieve great things, and how for other people it really causes them to stumble. Mm-hmm. So I've always been really interested in stories like that. And especially like, you know, the rags to riches stories. I love those.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, being a podcaster looking for those stories, you know, I'm sure that, you know, is a driver for that. So when you guys come to the States, you know, just on my basic creeping on the internet to get your background, you ended up in LA or Chicago, and then you went to Pepperdine, right?
Yeah. So basically, I mean, there's a huge Polish community in Chicago. Pretty much if you're Polish and you're immigrating to the US, you're likely going to Chicago.
There is in Pittsburgh, there is Polish Hill. There is literally, yeah. So, I mean, it's nowhere near the size of Chicago, but there is a neighborhood called Polish Hill. But I know, yeah, Chicago's got like, I mean, huge Polish community.
Huge. I've heard that it's the second largest Polish community outside of Warsaw. Yeah, so we went to Chicago. I grew up outside of Chicago in a suburb, and, you know, parents really ingrained the importance of education for me. And I came out to Los Angeles for the first time to go to college. So I went to college out here in Los Angeles, and then I went to grad school back home in Chicago at Northwestern. I've been kind of like all over the place, because when you work in news, you hop around a lot to various markets. You also sometimes on assignments. So I feel like in just the last 10, 15 years, I've just been all over the place, and it's kind of nice to have my feet more firmly planted for now.
Yeah, I bet. So Pepperdine, is it the Fighting Waves, or is it just the Waves?
The Waves.
Okay. Because I always recognize them from, you know, doing March Madness polls. You know, Pepperdine would always squeak in, and then and then going out to LA for like business, for the American Film Market. If I can stay when we go out there for business somewhere, I prefer Malibu. I mean, it's like really snooty to say now that I say that out loud. It's like, oh, I prefer Malibu. Like, you know, I can't be up in those, you know, hills or whatever. But I love the beach. And so that's the first time we stayed in Malibu is where I figured out where Pepperdine is. We're just driving. All of a sudden I was like, hey, Pepperdine University. No way. That's why they're called the Waves, because it's literally on the ocean. Did you ever, so the whole campus like overlooks the Pacific Coastal Highway and just the water, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful campus. It's high, it's up on like a hill, and we overlook the Pacific Ocean, like you said. You know, everyone assumes that the students are just at the beach every day, and that's not true. I should have gone to the beach more. I really should have taken advantage of it. But no, it's a really good school. I was really blessed to go there. I liked that it was small, so it had a very strong sense of community. It had really strong media programs, so I was able to do like television shows from when I was a freshman, like create them, produce them, host them, serve as like a news correspondent. And I spent two of my years actually, or basically four semesters, so basically 2 years in Italy. I studied Italian.
Oh wow, that's awesome. So what brought the Italian, you know, into focus? What was your desire there? Is that just something you're always fascinated with, or?
Well, you know how, you know, in secondary school, you choose French or German or Spanish.
Yeah.
So I chose French, and I was really good at French, actually. And I really wanted to study abroad in France. And it just so happened that when I went to Pepperdine, they had like an issue with the program. I think it was like an issue with the housing or something there. So they canceled the French program for the year that I was supposed to go. So it was either not going at all overseas and doing the study abroad, or choosing a different country and a different language. So everyone recommended the Italian program, and I had never taken Italian prior to that. But I said, you know what? My mom had been to Italy, and I had been to Italy when I was little, but I didn't remember. And so everyone really encouraged me to try that program. And I fell in love. Like, I went to Florence, and I completely fell in love with the culture. I traveled every single weekend. Like, I don't think there's like a nook or cranny of Italy that I haven't explored. I've gone back every single year since. It's like a huge passion of mine. It was just something I pursued, and I actually ended up creating the Italian major at Pepperdine, because they didn't have a major of Italian.
They should give you a discount for that, right? If you create a major, they should, you know, say, all right, you know what, your degree's free.
I should get free flights to Italy for life. That's what I should get.
Yeah, I guess that would probably pay off better for you. So I got to ask then, because is that in up by your Emmy, is that the picture of, what's it called? Is that the Jesus Christ? My father's a deacon. He's going to kill me for not knowing the name of this. What is the name of that picture?
Isn't it the Sacred Heart or the
Blue? Yeah, the Sacred Heart. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. He's Catholic. You know, I've basically lived in two countries that are very, very Catholic, Poland and Italy. Mm-hmm. My faith is very important to me. And that's Jesus.
Yeah, that's cool to see, because Lamar and I ended up having like a pretty good in-depth, he's a Christian, conversation. I'm born and raised Catholic, and like, you know, and I say that like where I'm not, I always tell people I'm not indoctrinated. Like, I challenged, you know, my faith, in, you know, probably college time, like where I was just like, I took this course called, Origins of Christianity. And my dad, who I know is probably going to listen to this, I remember him being very worried because it was like the teacher was, it was a year long, two semester course. And she's like, we're going to go over the origins of Christianity. We're going to read the Gospels as they're written. We're going to learn how writing was done back then, you know, and all that kind of stuff where, you know, you figure out like very simple things, like, you know, they didn't write literal all the time, you know, and they talked in different ways and it was just normal. So I was kind of like nervous going into that, but it ended up making my faith stronger. And it's always been important to me as well. So that's, I saw that right away. I was like, oh, no way. Like another, like, you gotta be a strong Catholic if you have that hanging up.
Yeah, I love the symbols of Catholicism. I love crosses and I love the saints. And yeah, like my like grandma wears, you know, saints around her neck, and so does my mom. And I love it. I mean, it's so deeply rooted in tradition for my family. And then I went to Pepperdine, which was a Christian school, but it was a different denomination. But we had to take three religious courses. We had to take basically a historical course on the Old Testament, a historical course on the New Testament, and then a course on some other religion. And I studied Catholicism and the history of Catholicism in Italy. So it made me appreciate that even more. And I got to go to Mass in Italy. And I don't know, I've just always, I loved it. And something that I love about, you know, Catholicism, Catholic means universal. And just knowing that you could go to any church on Sunday and the readings are the same and, you know, kind of centers you and grounds you. And I love it.
Yeah, that was, you know, in college, whenever my buddy, like my best friend in college from Switzerland, and like when I'd go over with him in the summer and you know, the church there, it was like walked in, it was like the same thing. I mean, it was all in Swiss German, so it was a little confusing, but yeah, like it doesn't matter. So that's, I bring that up too, because so being in Italy, that had to have been like a big, I mean, I'm sure you went to the Vatican and all that kind of stuff and explored the, you know, historical religious sites and everything. What did you get to see?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I literally traveled all of, not only Italy, but I traveled all over Europe, because the way that the program at Pepperdine was set up is that you would have like a full day of classes, kind of like a job 9 to 6, Monday through Thursday. And then you would have Friday, Saturday, Sunday off so that you could really take advantage of traveling.
Oh, nice.
So everyone kind of got like a Eurorail pass. And I mean, this was like probably the best year of my life. I wish I could redo it. There are a few things I wish I could go back. Like I wish I could go back and redo my time in Florence. I wish I could go back in time and know about Bitcoin sooner.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, we explored Europe and it was so wonderful. And, you know, it's just such a night, and it wasn't the same social media atmosphere. So I'm so grateful for that too, because it sounds so small, but it was so, I'm so thankful that I didn't live in a time then where everyone's just like Instagramming, you know, taking a photo for Instagram and sitting with their head in their phone, their smartphones. Like that did not exist. We did not have smartphones with us in Italy. We really like enjoyed the experiences and became close as a group. And I, you know, became really close with some girlfriends who are still my lifelong friends. And I really, you know, I miss that. I wish that sometimes, you know, I love social media for the aspects that, you know, for my job, it helps and it's helped grow my career, but I kind of wish it didn't exist. I think it's probably done more harm than good for a lot of people.
Oh, I agree. That's what, like, you know, I've told people, like, I need to up my Twitter game to support the podcast, I guess. But I'm just like, I'm so apathetic about it where I'm like, boy, oh boy, I just don't care. You know, like I think because whenever I, you know, did research on you, we're about the same age. I was born in 86 as well.
You're gonna win my age.
I'll bleep it out. Don't worry.
I'm just kidding.
I'll just say that we're the same age. But yeah, the, you know, like summers back then, like, you know, we didn't have it. Like when we were in college, there was no, I mean, there's MySpace and like the beginnings of Facebook, but like you had to actually sit down and log into a computer. Yeah. And, you know, do stuff. And
Canon power shots. Those were we didn't have the iPhones and like the phone cameras. I had like a power shot Canon that you would have to upload and like choose which pictures, or we also had the disposable, the Kodaks.
Oh yeah.
That was a simpler, nicer time.
Oh, so much simpler. And yeah, it was like, I remember going over and it was just like one of those weird things where it's like, okay, I'm leaving the United States. My phone will not work until I get back, you know? And it was like, and that was however long I was in Switzerland, my phone just was non-existent. And then came back and had a bunch of messages and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, nowadays it's absurd. It's too much.
Oh yeah. And like, I still keep tabs on like my school and like my sorority that I was a part of. And sometimes I'll be on Instagram, the Ponte Vecchio or the Eiffel Tower. And I don't even know if they're enjoying their time because they're so concerned about like posing in front of the certain statues. And like, you know, I just think Instagram is kind of funny in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Elena, did it kind of freeze for you there for a second?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. It is funny. You know, and I was talking to a friend of mine, like, so when I took my wife to the Alps, like in Switzerland, and we visited my friend before we had kids, and you just can't do that with little kids. You can't go to the Alps. And I was telling my buddy about like how, you know, experiencing life versus, you know, taking pictures of everything being on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And there was this was in the social media age, but we were like at the top of the Alps. And this snowflake fell down and like, honest to God, it was bigger than my head. And it was like, it had all the detail of that snowflake, like of a snowflake, but it was massive and it was just like fluttering. And we didn't rush to take a picture, you know, cause people always asked whenever I told that story, oh, do you have a picture of it? I was like, are you kidding me? Like, what was I going to do? Like, hurry up, like, oh, get the phone out. Like, we got to try to snap a picture of this so I can remember what that picture looked like instead of, like right now I have a vivid memory of what it actually looked like, you know?
Totally.
So anyway, so outside of all that, that's your, you know, Natalie Brunell background. And now we get you into the position where you discover Bitcoin for the first time. When does that happen?
So I was working up in Northern California for a local news affiliate, and I was visiting people in San Francisco who I knew, and one of them had a close friend who worked for Coinbase. And so we were hanging out, and they started talking about Bitcoin, and I was like, what's Bitcoin? And you know, I became curious. It was a couple thousand dollars at the time. And I didn't go down the rabbit hole. I'm not even sure the Bitcoin Standard, which is my favorite book, was released yet, or maybe it had recently been released, but I didn't know about it. So I was just, I thought what so many people probably think when they heard about it, that it's just like this digital funny money or something.
It's going to get hacked and, you know.
Yeah, it could get hacked and who knows who's behind it. But I was curious because I also recognized the fact that, you know, Silicon Valley and the tech companies that have started there have really changed our lives, you know, everything from Facebook to Uber and beyond. And so I felt like the people I was talking to just were up on some trends that I just didn't really understand yet with regards to cryptocurrency or blockchain. So I bought really not really understanding or knowing much about it. And then it wasn't until the pandemic that I went down the rabbit hole and just like really studied, read multiple books, started devouring blog posts, and found all of the people that I've been interviewing for my podcast and tried to absorb their knowledge and why they believe in it. And then I became really passionate about just learning about economics and finance and investing. And it's been a really great eye-opening experience because it's really changed my worldview about a lot of things, and it's changed my perspective on a lot of the stories that I've covered over the years, because I've been in the trenches for so long as a reporter, and I've seen a lot of the issues plaguing society at a very up close and personal level. And I sometimes didn't really understand what caused a lot of those problems, or I didn't understand the big picture. I didn't understand how economics or money printing could be involved. And Bitcoin has really allowed me to lift that veil and think about things in a different way and think about sort of the trickle down effects of fractional reserve banking and government debt and just some of the things that have happened under the fiat system, for better or for worse. I'm really glad I started to look into it because it's just changed. It's changed the way I look at things.
Yeah, that's the best way. I mean, I'm, you know, a pandemic born Bitcoiner, mm-hmm. As well. And like, it just, it's amazing how it changes, you know, literally everything, like the way you look at everything, where it's just like, you know, do I need that? I don't need to spend that money. Like, why would I spend that money? I'm going to save it. You know, even though, you know, most likely it's going to end up going into Bitcoin. You know, the idea behind saving and personal responsibility. So I assume then, like, cause with me, when I saw them, like, oh yeah, like their rumblings that there was going to be money printing, mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, this is never going to stop. So that was like my initial investment thesis. And it sounds like you kind of had a similar one.
Yeah. And I just became curious and aware of my own ignorance, where mm-hmm. it's like, I knew that we had low interest rates, right? You would put your money in Chase and get like 0.01% back.
Yeah, something ridiculous.
Yeah, but I didn't understand like how that works, like how interest rates work, and what money printing or quantitative easing really means. And when you have a system where basically, you know, debt for these massive corporations is extremely cheap. And then I think, you know, a lot of these things lead to the incredible wealth inequality and income disparity that we have, you know, and couple that with the inflation, which now at this point, I mean, I'm worried what will happen in the next 5 to 10 years. I really do, because I think that there's going to be consequences to printing this much money. And I don't know, it's just, I wish that more people had this type of knowledge, and like I wish that it was taught more in schools, like how to invest and how our economic system really works. But I guess how can it, because the system sort of, the education reinforces the current system. It's not going to teach you something that's going to go against it. So I don't know, it's just it's interesting to see where we are now with this pandemic, because I don't think we're going back to a pre-pandemic world as in terms of economics and monetary policy.
No, I mean, they're, I think I saw somebody posted that Biden said that the Fed should do everything it can to, you know, step in and support the economy. And for anyone out there that's like a Trump supporter or whatever, that thinks this wouldn't be happening if my guy was in there, I hate to break it to you, it'd be happening no matter who's in there, because it has been happening no matter who's in there for a while. And that's a tough pill to swallow. That's the hard part. Like, for me, that was the hardest part. Not kind of, I think discovering Bitcoin has lifted the veil on a lot of things in our political system for me. But just like, not just cementing, but like proving as fact that both, like all the political elites are not working for us. They're working together for themselves. And
yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's funny, like the other day, someone showed me some sort of headline where they accused Bitcoin of being some alt-right or super conservative. Like, and I'm like, you don't understand Bitcoin at all. Like Bitcoin, no, not left or right. It's like, yeah, individual sovereignty.
And it is completely independent, and it might have somebody way far left and way far right. And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. And I like, this is why I love Saifedean Ammous's writing. So he has the Bitcoin Standard, which is right behind me. And then I read his new book, Fiat Standard. And he really talks about how with politicians, I mean, I think everyone feels disillusioned right now by whoever represents them. It's like you kind of fail up in politics again, whether you're on the right or the left, you can't do anything wrong. And like you spend all this money and then you get reelected, even if you did a poor job. And it's just, I think a lot of people, especially in the last decade, have just felt so frustrated with the system. I think it's one of the reasons why Trump was elected, because people feel like the system's rigged. They feel like there's this, you know, I mean, when you see a politician and they live in a $41 million house, it's like, what is wrong with that? There's something wrong, because that should be public service, and you shouldn't, I don't understand a world where a politician is making, you know, as much as a CEO of a corporation. And I think Bitcoin sort of helps bring awareness to those kinds of problems and sheds light on like how we can maybe fix that, because the system is super broken. And I think people feel frustrated that there seems to be no way out. And no matter who gets elected, the problems just fester and continue, and all this money gets thrown out there and then things just continue to get worse. So like, I don't know. I just, it's a fascinating time we're in. We really are. And as a journalist, I will go, you know, I will try to hunt you down for corruption, whether you're on the right or the left. Like I want to expose you. I don't care.
You want to expose it no matter what. Yeah.
Cause there's corruption on both sides. And one thing that I'm always passionate about is exposing hypocrisy. I hate hypocrisy. Like if you vote one way or you preach one thing and then you do something yourself that goes against that, it drives me up the wall. And I think so many people think today's politicians are hypocrites. A lot of them.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, and like even like across like the media, like with Bob Iger at Disney, I remember him, Georgia passed the heartbeat bill for abortion, you know, like getting closer to like pro-life type laws. And he said, we're going to seriously reconsider filming movies in Georgia because of this heartbeat bill. And I'm like, boy, if Bob Iger hates the Georgia abortion laws, wait till he sees the ones in Ireland and, you know, X number of other countries that they currently, you know, take advantage of their tax credits and film in, that it's completely illegal, you know. And it's just the hypocrisy and the virtue signaling that's just so empty. Like, it's just so it's so shallow and they're so hypocritical. And, you know, I mean, all this like preaching about climate emergency and then jetting around on their private jets, like, give me a break. Like how stupid do they think we are? You know?
Yeah. Hypocrisy is definitely something that it drives me crazy. It really does.
Well, the thing that's, I like about it though, is that I think they're so stupid that they don't understand that we all can see through them. Like for the most part, you know, there's people that fall for it, but like all of them just sitting there with their, like their dead smiles and like, you know, oh, like how did Nancy Pelosi make a buttload of money off of the stock market, and you know, who were all those Republicans that were doing insider trading, right? But you know, it's like, what in the world is going on? Like, how dumb do they think we are? Yeah, it's hypocrisy to the next level. So you think Bitcoin really kind of shatters like people's world views? Like that's something I'm starting to notice. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that when I learned about sort of the history of money and the history of our central banking system and how we moved from the gold standard to fiat backed by pretty much nothing at this point, and just the changes within society that have come with that, that's what it gives me hope, is like the idea that Bitcoin is this digital scarce asset. It is digital gold that can't be inflated. It can't be corrupted. And if we were to say peg, like what if we were to peg the dollar to Bitcoin and you couldn't just print as much as possible, right? Like how would our world change? Like how would our economic system look? Would it be a little bit more fair? Because again, the system right now, it really, offers advantages to people who have a ton of money or who have massive corporations mm-hmm. or conduct mass production. And I think that there's opportunity to equalize with Bitcoin. I went to some panels at the Bitcoin conference about Bitcoin and morality, which were interesting. And they kind of delved into almost like Christian elements of just bringing out our best selves and working, you know, for your highest potential in a fair system where the money is sound, the money is hard, it can't be corrupted, it can't be just stolen and given to the rich. So yeah, I just, you know, that's obviously very lofty. And I think people can't grasp onto this idea because it sounds like rainbows and butterflies, right? Like Bitcoin's not going to necessarily make the world perfect. But I do think that it's interesting for people to explore this, the difference between when we had hard money and under the gold standard versus today when we have just money printing like crazy. And the only reason I think we've been able to get away with it for so long is because everyone relies on the dollar as the global reserve asset. But, and you know, so everyone's printing, but I think it's going to catch up to us.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, and I knew that they printed money when they did the bailouts in 2008, but you know, really, like, I'll never forget, I think I was cutting my grass and I was listening to maybe Preston Pish on Peter McCormick's podcast, and he brought up quantitative easing. That was the first time I had ever heard that phrase, and he's talking about quantitative easing and what it is and how they've basically been printing money. And like I stopped the lawnmower and started like Googling, like what quantitative easing. I was like, oh my God. And like, I literally wanted to run in the house and sell everything. I was like, it's all going down. Like, this is all like this dollar. You know, I wanted to go in my glove compartment in the car and get that, like, you know, emergency $20 bill in case I forget my wallet. Like, get that, like, this paper is worth nothing, you know, and sell it all for Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's really sad. One of my last guests, Michael Saylor, you know, he's like the lord of Bitcoin. He has some really insightful things that he talked about with regards to why so many people are just naive to the situation. And it's because their stocks have been doing well because of stock like asset inflation, and their homes have maybe appreciated in value. So if you have had a home, it's good, right? It's like a seller's market. And it's worth a lot more than you paid for it. But when you look at like day to day, I mean, how much you're making versus the rate of inflation, how much like everyday things cost, how much the cost of education is, like, it's getting more and more impossible to live in the United States. And it's really sad. And you have to have a ton of money. You have to be rich basically to have a normal life and, you know, multiple people working, because how can you survive on one income today? And just 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't like that. So, you know, what's the problem and how do we fix it? And again, it's not like Bitcoin's the one all the one fits all solution, but I think that it kind of exposes this idea that we need to look at our monetary system in this country and what we've been doing and how to maybe walk that back a little bit and offer people a chance to really make money for themselves and take care of their families and provide. I mean, you should be able to put money away in the bank and it should be enough. You should be able to save and like not worry that that money is now going to erode every single year 7% in value because of inflation, because of how much money is being printed. Like, that's not fair. It's not fair to all the hardworking people out there who just want a normal life. Like, and I always think of my parents, you know, they didn't come here to be millionaires. They didn't come here to be Jeff Bezos and have a yacht. They came to like have a house and a nice vacation once a year and be able to provide school for their kids. Like, and I would say that most Americans feel that way. They don't, mm-hmm. they don't want to bother anybody. They pay their taxes and they just want to be able to put their money away and not see it disappear. And it's like today you have to work until you die almost. And for some people that's the reality. Or you have to get, you know, you have to have a second job as like a day trader, hire an investment banker because you have to invest in these inflating assets because that's the only way you can actually make money as opposed to just putting it in the bank. And so, yeah, it's just sad that we've come to this place. And if there's a solution, why don't we try to figure out what it is?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like Bitcoin's the parachute. And we're just screaming down towards the earth with no pair, you know, and then we realized, oh, we have a parachute. So at some point, you know, like at different levels of altitude is when people pull the ripcord, you know, like Hal Finney pulled it like right when he jumped out of the plane. And then, you know, Guy Swan pulled it like, you know, after 10 seconds of free fall. But then there's, you know, me and you that, you know, we pulled it probably, I don't know, in the long term before Bitcoin takes over, maybe it'll be like a quarter of the way down because I still think we have a long way to go. But all those other people are just waiting, and then it's going to come down to the last person waiting to pull the ripcord, and it's going to be like the moment that they realize, like, oh my God, I better do something or I'm going to explode into dust into the earth, you know? And it's a shame. I just wish that, you know, more people could be educated about it. You know, what do you think? Yeah. Do you think, you know, we see retail picking it up, but when do you think we're going to start seeing like the average American household adopting it to, you know, kind of stave off the bad effects of, you know, inflation?
So I really do think that we're just going to have to come to a, you know, sort of a scary situation with regards to inflation taking off, because if this continues, you know, we're already seeing it in grocery prices and all that. And I know that they're saying it's transitory, but a lot of people don't believe that, especially in the Bitcoin world. So I think it's going to take something like that where everything's just getting so much more, it's getting harder to ignore that inflation exists. And also the price action of Bitcoin, I think, has to resume, because right now a lot of people are who aren't familiar with Bitcoin, I think the volatility is very scary since it's already such an expensive asset. And a lot of people aren't familiar with the notion of stacking sats or anything like that. So I think that the momentum, some institutions will need to come in for the price to go back up for retailer and in retail investors who are new to it to be like, okay, I don't want to miss the boat this time around. But you know, I don't know. I didn't expect this correction to last so long. I thought by summer we would sort of regain at least the 40s and 50s. I'm really surprised that we haven't, you know, gone back up, but at the same time, like, I don't worry about it. I don't stress because I don't see Bitcoin as a trade or as something that I'm trying to sell within the next year. I literally look at it as like a really long-term investment and my time horizon's long. And I want it to plan for my future. I don't want it for my expenses day to day. So yeah, it's stressful, but I try not to think about the price too much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's freeing. You know, I recommend to people, you know, if you can get into a position where I say I have my fiat life and then I have my Bitcoin life. So my fiat life is just, you know, like, you know, my regular income that is coming in and paying for bills, all that kind of stuff. Anything extra goes straight into Bitcoin. And that helps you not sweat the price. And it is like freeing, you know, to go, like, I think I went like 4 or 5 days without checking the price. And I was like, oh my God, like, I didn't check the price. And like, I checked it and I was like, ah, okay. You know, I mean, I assume if it like took off in the wrong or right direction steeply and quickly, you know, something would alert me to it. You know, somebody text me and say, hey, do you see what's going on? But yeah, it's just, I don't know. I wonder, what do you think? Like, 'cause there's a lot of crabbiness in the Bitcoin Twitter right now. If I don't know if you've noticed that, like everybody's kind of getting sick of hanging in this 30 range. And, you know, from what I understand, this is what happens whenever it goes flat for a while, is that everybody starts kind of getting a little grouchy. Do you think that comes from people being too leveraged or people, you know, like overcommitting to and, you know, putting everything on riding on Bitcoin? I mean, what do you think causes that kind of, or is it just number go up was so fun, so let's keep doing that again?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really like Bitcoin Twitter, and I guess I haven't noticed. I've had a little bit of the responses, like when I posted some of my interviews, Michael Saylor, for example, there have been those rude, ridiculous comments where they're like, oh, you know, it's going down and it's crashing, you know, don't listen to him. But for the most part, I feel like the community is really strong, and this makes it makes the hodlers even stronger. Like if you're holding through these sort of, I don't know if I would even call this a bear market. It's just kind of I would still call it a correction at this point. Maybe it'll be a really big bear market. I don't know. But I think it strengthens the community that we held, you know, we believe in it. Our conviction is strong despite the price drop. I think a lot of people are frustrated if they bought in toward the 40, 50 level, which, like, and I continue to dollar cost average. So I'll be honest, I'm one of those people, and it's a bummer to think that I could have waited a little bit and had more for what I put in. But at the same time, it's still early, and I love Bitcoin Twitter. They've been so supportive of me getting into the space with no finance background, no economics background, and just this, you know, podcast. So I love Bitcoin Twitter. I guess I don't pay attention to the crabbies.
Yeah, I try. I don't know. Maybe it's because I just don't try so much on the, I don't know. Maybe I should try more to filter out. Yeah, it seems like I see a lot of like, you know, people just like, oh, when's the number going to go up? And it's like, it's just chill, you know, it's like, that's not what life is all about. I mean, you know, this could be like life changing and change everything for the rest of the world, if everything goes right. But yeah, so who do you think is Satoshi Nakamoto? Because I'm making a documentary called Searching for Satoshi, and it's not about finding Satoshi. It's about, you know, basically we all are Satoshi. You know, and it's, I think it's important that we'll never find out, but it is kind of a fun thing to ask. Like, what if you had to take a guess, you know, somebody was like, look, I'll pay you $100 to give me your, you know, best guess on who Satoshi is, who would you say it was?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I don't think it's like anyone that whose name I would know within the space. I think it's a very brilliant engineer who maybe had some exposure to Austrian economics and who created something that I don't even think he really understood the potential of in terms of widespread adoption. I don't know if necessarily Satoshi created it with the expectation that it could become a global reserve asset, but maybe an example of hard money or an example of what the gold standard represented. But I just think it's like some really smart person that maybe attends the Bitcoin conference, you know, in a clandestine way and like kind of has a chuckle to himself about the fact that he created all of this. But I don't know. I don't have a guess of like a person. I don't believe that it was the CIA. I don't believe that it was like the president of some other country. I think it's just some really, really smart person.
I have a friend who he's like, oh, you know, you can't rule out that it's the, you know, the central bankers and the elites and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, I mean, I guess you, in theory, you can't rule it out, but like, why would they do something to give up control of money? You know, like, because there is, you know, even like people who are poo-pooing El Salvador, you know, it's like, well, you know, at the very least, like they brought something in that they can't control. You know, like, yeah, that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I don't believe that because I think it just goes against that power narrative and the ability to maintain power through getting reelected. So, yeah. I don't think it was some political actor. I don't.
I like to think that it'd be like some kind of like surfer dude that is like a brilliant and then like just like one day was like, you know, I have this idea and like types up the white paper, throws it out there, messes around with it a little bit, gets it going, and then like disappears off the face of the earth because he's just like focused on surfing and then like comes in like, what? No way. You know, like, yeah, this thing is worth like $1,000 now, you know. Just, I mean, yeah, to think about like what, you know, it is fun to think about whoever Satoshi is, like if they're still out there, like they've got, they probably are sitting there going like, oh my God, like I can't believe this is, you know, because they had the solution. They knew the problem. They knew how to fix the problem. But what were the odds that they thought it was actually going to take off? You know? Yeah.
I mean, I agree. I don't know that they understood its true potential. You know, you can predict something like the pandemic changing the economic system across the entire world. So, yeah. And I just, but being born out of the last financial crisis, this was a very smart individual. And I wish we did know who it was, but ultimately it also doesn't matter. Like I've been asked before on other podcasts, like, does it make you not believe in it because you don't know who the creator is? Like, doesn't that make you not trust it? And I was like, no, actually, because that's the point of Bitcoin, is there is no executive, there is no institution, there is no president. It's all of us. It's like the network reinforcing itself. It's truly decentralized. It is literally the definition of like the common good or like the people's say. So yeah, I think Bitcoin's cool, who regardless of who Satoshi is.
There's a touch of divinity to it too, you know, mm-hmm, of like divine intervention.
Yeah.
Like my sci-fi mind, I said there could be, there's a 1% chance that he's from the future and just like sent it back. But like, it is insane to think about the timing of it, where it's like, you know, if you were like 200 years in the future and you're like, all right, we got to put this reserve currency in and it'll solve all the problems. When's the best time to do it? It's like, how about right at the financial collapse, 2008? Okay. Yeah. Oh yeah. That's 13 years before or 12 years before the pandemic. So I'll give it enough time to pick up traction. And then, you know, all the governments will start printing like crazy. And, you know, it's just like, I don't know. I mean, if that theory plays out, that'd be really fun to watch what's going to happen next. I mean, either fun or bad, because, you know, we're going to probably get a little crazy here. If we have to get to a Bitcoin standard, I mean, what do you think gets us there?
So, I mean, this is kind of going a little bit in the weeds, but I follow a lot of macro strategists who follow the markets. And there are a lot of them who are predicting a massive crash because we are in this place where we keep on printing and, you know, God forbid we have more shutdowns, it's going to prompt even more printing and stimulus. I think at some point there needs to be, you know, coming to terms with reality and tapering. And I think if something crashes the market, that will prompt even more printing because our country does not allow recessions or depressions anymore, right? We just kick in the printer. And so at that point, if inflation really takes off and we're in that danger zone, I think that that will be a great value proposition for Bitcoin, but I think it also puts the US dollar in a very dangerous position. And there are so many people out there. I think it was like Jeffrey, I forgot who was saying the other day, but like a lot of people don't believe that the US dollar will be the global reserve currency in say 5-10 years. A lot of the strategists I follow don't. So I think that,
Which is crazy. Like that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, I agree with them, but it's crazy that that many people think that in, that's not bigger news.
Yeah. And the general public would, I mean, if you said that on the news, people would be like, absolutely not. And I think, you know, Americans, especially, we have this view that like we can't fall, like, but Rome fell, you know, it's like, yeah. we can, and we're kind of going in that direction. We're lucky that we are the global reserve currency because it's sheltered us from that since everyone relies on the US dollar. But I think that a lot will change in the next 10 years. Cause again, I think that too much money has been printed. There's too much leverage and debt in the system that needs to shake out. The different countries will start launching their own central bank digital currencies. And I think we're just in the middle of this massive shift. One of the people I interviewed on my podcast, Raul Paul, he said, we're in the middle of this like changing architecture. It's like a new digital architecture for money. And I don't know, I can't predict the future. And I think that there's going to be some more political division as a result of some of these issues happening. But I think it's a great value proposition for Bitcoin because it's scarce. There's only going to be 21 million. And if you get a piece of that, then if that keeps going up in value, then you sort of protect yourself from all the outside forces that are happening and all the people, you know, fighting over monetary policies and stimulus. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
So I got to ask, you mentioned Raul Paul as one of your, guess, are you Bitcoin only, or are you, you know, do you experiment a little bit with like Ethereum, anything like that? Or and I mean, story wise, are you just going for like crypto stories in general, since, you know, people are all over the place?
No, so I don't focus on crypto for my other job. I just focus on crypto for my podcast. But I do, I'm Bitcoin and Ethereum only, primarily Bitcoin, but I am interested in just like the smart contracts and sort of the platform infrastructure that exists. But Bitcoin, I believe, is like the gold version, digital. Mm-hmm. And I'm wary of all the other altcoins and, you know,
the Doge coins and
and it scares me when people say they're into crypto and then they own something that I've never heard of and these like random tokens. And again, I worry for them because I feel like they haven't done the homework and really researched this space or understood blockchain. And yes, I understand that Bitcoin's very expensive, but I think that they're buying a lot of those coins because they're cheap and they're hoping that they take off. And it's just a completely speculative gamble that has no basis in the underlying technology, that has no awareness of what the monetary policy is and whether all the coins could be created or, you know, removed at any given time. So that scares me. And I wish people would do more homework because I think that Bitcoin's, you know, much more significant and reliable of a network and crypto than any other.
Did you see that altcoin that was created over the weekend, or like somebody posted the message over the weekend, and they went to lock it up for 6 months, and because they did like a pre-sale, and then they said, you know, that the people did the pre-sale, which, you know, I mean, how do you do pre-sale on something that's supposed to be scarce? And they said, we wanted to lock up the liquidity for 6 months, but they accidentally locked it up for like 50,000 years. There was like a calculation that they like miscalculated. And so it's, you know, they were like posting messages like, does anybody know if there's anything we can do to like unlock this? Because, you know, just that's why you don't dabble in.
Be careful. Financial advice, just be careful, do your homework.
I know. Yeah. Do your own research and figure that out. So, where do you see us going here? I mean, you know, you're new here like me, so, you know, no financial advice, but I mean, you know, I think that the China mining had something to do with the price going down, but I'm not an expert in any of these things. I'm just looking at like a macro perspective, and I'm curious, since you study a lot of the macro people, you know, you look at the big trends and not the day-to-day, like, of Elon tweeting, like, who cares? You know what I mean? Like, I think it's kind of funny that Elon thinks he can influence the market, and it really could have just been like the mining rigs getting shut off and everything that was coming with China. So from a macro perspective, you know, what are you kind of reading between the lines and what people are saying, and, you know, where do you see a shifting here?
Well, these are some of the things I ask my guests about, because I don't know. But my guests, like, their answers have ranged from definitely the mining causing the correction. Some of them do believe that Elon's tweet, at least on like a retail level, impacted the price. And then others say, you know, like Grayscale Bitcoin bought a lot and now it's trading on a discount, before it was at a premium. So I think there are a lot of different components. I think it just got too hot and frothy and bubbly, and a lot of people FOMO'd at the wrong time and bought in, and then like the weak hands sold. So I personally don't really know. I'm just curious where it's going to go and what massive institution potentially will help, you know, maybe get us back into the other direction. But you know, I'm just kind of waiting to see what happens. And again, my time horizon's long, so I'm not overly worried. Would I love the price to be higher right now? Sure. But I'm also not worried about it.
Yeah. Well, hey, I'll let you get running. I know we started a little late, but thanks for coming on. And where can people find you? And, you know, let them know. I mean, your new podcast and your other podcasts that you have going as well, and, you know, where they can find you on TV or Twitter, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. So my podcast about Bitcoin is called Coin Stories. You can find it on Apple, Google Play, Spotify, as well as on YouTube. And you can follow me on Twitter at Nat Brunel or on Instagram at Natalie Brunel.
Awesome. Well, Natalie, thank you so much. We'll have to do this again sometime. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me.
See ya.